Imagine being a teenager in the 1920s. You wake up, you walk out to check your 20-acre field of just pristine, beautiful oats, and you find it completely trampled, ruined.
Oh man, just heartbreaking.
Yeah, totally. You realize a neighbor deliberately drove his cattle through like a mile and a half of thick bush just to destroy your hard work.
Wow.
And, you don't have a police force to call. You don't have lawyers out there on the prairie. So what do you do?
Right, what's the move?
Well, you don't say a word. Instead, you wake up before dawn, you round up 25 cows, and you quietly herd them directly into that neighbor's fenced-in crop. Complete devastation.
That is amazing.
Right. It is basically the 1920s equivalent of an untraceable cyber attack.
It really is. I mean, it's raw, unregulated frontier justice.
Yeah.
And the craziest part is the neighbor never complained because he knew exactly why it happened.
Yeah.
It was just a perfectly executed deterrent.
Exactly. And we are going to get to the full context of that incredible spotted off a little later, but we're starting there because it really sets the tone for a very special, custom-tailored deep dive
I
today.
heard.
We are unpacking a remarkable piece of your family history. This isn't just, a collection of dates or boring land deeds. This is the Roland Elaine memoir.
And the origins of this source material are just fascinating on their own. I mean, this incredibly detailed firsthand account of growing up in Saskatchewan in the early 1900s. It wasn't actually formally published in your 1987 family book.
Right, the Onward to the Unknown book.
Exactly. It wasn't in there. It was actually found as a loose photocopy, just tucked inside a copy of that book.
That's so wild to me.
Yeah, Roland Elaine wrote it in 1985 during his 71st year.
It's literally a fragile survivor of a document. And it's this vivid, laugh out loud, and honestly, sometimes genuinely shocking window into your roots. So today, we're taking you back in time to relive the mischief, the physical hardships, and the sheer ingenuity of your ancestors.
So, starting from his birth in 1913 in the town of Delmas, Roland was, well, by his own admission, the only red-headed boy in town.
Which he claimed made him incredibly spoiled by the locals, right?
Right. But I mean, spoiled in the early 1900s on the prairie meant something entirely different than it does today.
Oh, completely different.
Yeah.
When we think of kids playing today, we picture like curated play dates, iPads, maybe a heavily safety-tested plastic playground.
Padded corners everywhere.
Yes. But these isolated prairie kids had to construct entire universes out of, well, dirt and rocks.
They really did.
Like Roland and his friends would play ranching, but their toys were literally just colored stones. The blue stones were the bulls, the smaller stones were the calves.
And they'd use bits of string to outline their corrals.
Yeah. We might look at that today and think, wow, that sounds incredibly boring.
But if you look at the psychology of what they were actually doing, it's brilliant. They weren't playing wizards or superheroes. They were meticulously mimicking the agrarian survival skills of their parents.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah, playing ranching with stones is how a toddler processes the immense labor-intensive world around them. That agrarian lifestyle was just embedded in their brains before they could even read.
I mean, I totally understand mimicking the adults, but I really struggle to understand the sheer lack of self-preservation in some of these games.
Oh, they were fearless or just reckless.
Reckless is the word. Let's look at the lady and her dog incident.
Oh, boy.
So Roland's older sister, Yvonne, decides she's going to be this elegant lady, and Roland is designated as the dog. She puts this fuzzy yellow coat on him, ties a rope around his neck, and leads him around.
And Roland just fully commits to the bit.
He's a method actor. He's lifting his leg at chairs. He's actively trying to bite the other kids.
Until he decides to crawl through the high chair.
Yes, getting himself stuck so completely that his mother literally had to find a saw. She had to saw off a wooden rung of the high chair to free him.
And his reward for this immersive performance was a massive spanking.
Massive, which remarkably didn't seem to deter his imagination in the slightest.
Not at all. Because then, we get to the egg hatching experiment.
Oh my gosh, this kid.
Right. So Roland hears this rumor from some older boys that if you just sit on chicken eggs yourself, you can hatch them.
Naturally.
So he builds a nest in the old house, physically sits down on a clutch of eggs, and has Yvonne sneak him crackers so he can survive the incubation period.
I just have to ask, was this kid considered a visionary at the time, or was he just completely detached from reality?
I'd argue he was simply applying the scientific method, using the only materials he had. He formed a hypothesis based on tall tales, built a controlled environment, and ran the experiment.
Well, he ran it until his mother found him and introduced him to her famous Will-O-Wip.
Yeah, the physical discipline of the era is definitely jarring to our modern sensibilities.
It really is.
But as we move from like innocent play into how Roland and his siblings interacted with the adult world, we see this fascinating system of boundaries being constantly tested and then violently corrected.
It honestly feels incredibly chaotic. Like Yvonne actually orchestrates this brilliant, if totally doomed, money laundering scheme.
Oh, the coins.
Yeah. She sneaks money out of her dad's pockets,
yeah.
hides the coins under boards all around the yard, and then takes Roland on a walk to conveniently find this hidden treasure.
So they can go spend it at the store without raising suspicion.
Exactly. A scheme that falls apart almost immediately, obviously. Ending with Yvonne in tears, forced to march back to the store and return the new doll she had just bought.
That one's fairly standard kid behavior, I think. But the Saskatoon hospital trip, that's where I start to wonder if these kids were just exceptionally wild.
Okay, set this one up, because it is wild.
So Roland's mom is sick, so his dad takes him to Saskatoon and drops him off with cousin Anna. The dad hands Roland $4 total. He explicitly says, give $2 to Anna and keep $2 for yourself.
Simple enough instruction?
You'd think, but Roland looks at the money and he notices one bill has a 2 printed on it and is a different color. So he hands Anna that single $2 bill and keeps the 2 single dollars for himself.
It is a spectacular misunderstanding of currency value.
Or a brilliant scam.
See, I don't buy that it was a simple misunderstanding. I think he invented his own form of creative accounting. He knew exactly what he was doing and found a literal loophole to exploit.
I look at it a bit differently. I mean, he was operating with an incredible amount of independence for a young child, navigating adult transactions in a city away from home.
That's true. He was very young.
He applied a very literal logic to the instructions. Give two. He gave the piece of paper with the 2 on it.
Fair point.
But regardless of whether it was innocent or calculated, it really brings up the mechanism of how these kids learn their morality. In a town like Delmas, which was like 98% Catholic, discipline was not a private family matter.
The entire community acted as a panopticon. Everyone was watching.
That is the perfect word for it. When Roland and his friends started stealing their own family's eggs to sell on the black market to Mr. Roy, the local storekeeper, it wasn't the parents who caught them.
Right. Mr. Roy interrogated them himself.
Exactly. He figured out the hustle and shut it down personally. The community was the moral guardrail.
Or, you know, they relied on the threat of the croque-mitaine.
Ah, the bogeyman, a psychological tool used by every single parent in town to keep kids from wandering into the dark.
Which they desperately needed, because these kids were completely feral. Just look at the tragic comedy of Armand.
Poor Armand.
Their 16-year-old nephew visiting from down east. Armand spends all his money on these punchboard games and miraculously wins a massive 10-pound box of chocolates.
Which was a huge deal back then.
Oh, he's so proud of this prize. But Roland and his buddies decide to steal some. They hide in a walk-in closet to eat them. And when Armand comes walking up the stairs, Roland panics, steps backward, and puts his foot directly through the massive box of chocolates.
Just completely ruins the entire prize.
Armand was devastated. He swore he would never give Roland anything ever again.
It's a harsh lesson in consequences. And, you know, they were tripping over cultural barriers just as often as chocolate boxes.
Like the high jackass incident.
Yes. So Delmas was predominantly French-speaking, and there was apparently only one English family in town, the Holgates.
Right.
Roland is at the skating rink, and a buddy convinces him that the English phrase for how are you is, hi, jackass.
Just setting him up for total disaster.
Completely. So Roland skates up to this tall English teenager, Lawrence Holgate, cheerfully drops a hi, jackass, and then immediately realizes his mistake when Lawrence's face just turns beet red.
And starts chasing Roland around the rink.
Yeah, Roland literally had to skate for his life. If Lawrence hadn't been a terrible skater, Roland might not have survived to write this memoir.
It's a hilarious story, but I feel like it masks an underlying anxiety of the era. Like the consequences of childhood pranks were nothing compared to the genuine, unforgiving physical dangers of the prairie environment itself.
Absolutely. This is where my modern brain really struggles to process their reality.
Let's talk about the broken arm.
Oh, that is a tough one to read.
Roland is staying at a tent camp, 18 miles from town. He's riding his beloved pony, Jenny, going full speed, chasing a colt. Jenny steps into a badger hole and goes head over heels.
And Roland is launched like a human cannonball.
His arm goes straight down into a gopher hole as he lands. It twists completely backward.
Picture the sheer isolation of that moment. He is 18 miles from help. He has to walk all the way back to the tent, pale, in agonizing pain.
And terrified the whole way that a mean bull is going to charge him.
Right. And then comes this grueling wagon ride, followed by a car ride, just to finally reach a doctor.
And the medical care? I mean, this feels negligent by today's standards. The local doctor has no ether, no anesthesia whatsoever.
None.
He just has Roland's uncle grip his shoulder tightly while the doctor grabs the bottom of the backward arm and physically yanks it until the bone pops back into the socket.
It's brutal, but we can't really apply today's medical standards to frontier pragmatism. What stands out to me is the sheer mandatory stoicism required to survive that life.
Yeah, you just had to deal with it.
Pain was simply a roommate you had to tolerate. Roland's elbow never fully healed. It ached in damp weather for the rest of his entire life. But he couldn't afford to stop working.
It honestly sounds like living in a Wild West movie. But your outlaws aren't bandits. Your outlaws are badgers, runaway horses, and gopher holes.
And the adults had to be ruthlessly practical to fight back against those outlaws.
Right. Like Roland's dad. He dealt with crop-destroying gophers by heating up a half barrel of boiling water on a stone boat, driving out to the fields, and pouring boiling water straight down the holes.
It's incredibly efficient, but totally brutal.
So brutal.
You have to remember the stakes, though. A ruined crop meant starvation or losing the land. The animals were their livelihood, but nature was a constant active threat.
A threat that sometimes seemed to just defy all logic. Like the story of the young bull.
Oh, the train story.
Yeah, this young bull goes completely berserk, jumps a gate, gets up onto the railroad tracks, and starts chasing the railway workers.
Huh.
Then, the noon passenger train comes hurtling down the tracks.
And instead of running, the bull literally stands its ground. It squares up and challenges a rushing locomotive.
With, obviously, inevitably fatal results for the bull.
Nature was entirely raw. And the adults basically had to match that energy out of sheer necessity.
Like Uncle Frank Bellavance.
Right. Uncle Frank catches a steer trying to suckle milk from the family cow. He just loses his temper completely and starts beating the steer over the head with a stick.
And young Roland is horrified. He threatens to tell Grandma. And Uncle Frank turns to him and screams, "Get to hell home, you little bugger," threatening to give Roland the exact same treatment.
It's a harshness born of a brutal environment. The margin for error was just zero.
Which, to me, makes the family's next decision completely baffling.
The move.
Yes. In 1928, they undergo this massive exodus. They leave Delmas, which, you know, despite the bogeyman and the badger holes, is an established, relatively civilized prairie town.
Right.
And they move to the raw, untamed bush country of Vaillardville. I cannot wrap my head around this. Why pack up an established life to go to a place entirely made of mud swarming with mosquitoes? Was it purely financial greed?
Not greed. Opportunity and legacy. We tend to view history through the lens of comfort seeking, assuming the ultimate goal is always an easier life.
Yeah, yeah.
But the pioneer mindset is driven by expansion. Trading established comfort for raw acreage was really the only way to build a larger legacy for a growing family.
But the psychological toll on the teenagers must have been immense. It forced them to take on adult responsibilities literally overnight.
Oh, absolutely. And Roland's introduction to that new life was terrifying because the railway rules only allowed two people to ride free with the livestock and furniture.
So teenage Roland was designated as the stowaway. He spent the multi-day train ride hiding under oat sheaves in the boxcar.
Sweating in the dark, terrified to breathe too loudly in case the conductor discovered him and threw him off the train in the middle of nowhere.
He finally arrives in the bush, and before his mother even makes the trip up, Roland is put in charge of cooking for the men.
Which goes about as well as you'd expect.
He decides to make split pea soup, but he doesn't know you have to soak and slow cook them. He basically just warms up a pot of raw hard peas and serves it.
Poor Mr. Bernier.
Mr. Bernier takes a bite, crunches down so hard it sounds like gravel,
yeah.
And his nose immediately starts bleeding from the sheer force of chewing.
The men found it hilarious, of course, but his father permanently banned him from trying any more wild recipes in the camp.
Well, the animals they relied on in the bush were just as wild as the recipes. They had this dog named Jip, incredibly smart, but lacked any sort of nuance.
Right, zero chill.
None. Roland would tell her to go round up the milk cows, and she would bring them back at a full, terrifying sprint. She ran them so hard one day that two cows tried to squeeze through a gate at the exact same millisecond.
And just completely smashed the posts to splinters.
That kind of isolation, though, breeds a very specific type of ingenuity. Roland and his friend Gene Lessard were operating as essentially unsupervised adults in a vast wilderness.
And they used that autonomy to build an 11-dog sled team out of stray dogs from town.
Which is amazing. They were basically engineering their own transit system. They hollowed out a straw stack and hid the dogs underneath it so their fathers wouldn't hear the barking and shut down the operation.
It shows an incredible mechanical aptitude mixed with, you know, a healthy dose of teenage rebellion.
Especially considering their lead dog was named Suitcase.
I love that detail.
He earned that name because he was fundamentally incapable of learning the verbal commands for left and right. To turn the sled, Roland literally had to jump off, grab the dog by the backstrap, pick him up like a piece of luggage, point him in the new direction, and yell mush.
You see how these young men are entertaining themselves, surviving, and solving complex problems in a total vacuum of formal entertainment.
Yeah, they were also navigating the adults in that vacuum, which brings us full circle to that frontier justice story we started with. Villardville was remote. You encounter massive eccentricities out there.
Extreme isolation does strange things to the human psyche.
Look at Hector Maynard. He was a bachelor homesteader who was so utterly terrified of bears and the wilderness around him, he couldn't sleep.
So he cut down green poplar poles and built a locked cage inside his own shack.
He would crawl into this indoor cage, lock it from the inside, and only then could his brain relax enough to fall asleep.
It is a physical manifestation of psychological trauma from the environment. When you don't have a society to protect you, you literally build a cage.
Or you enforce your own laws, like the Revenge of the Oats. Roland, now a young man, has this pristine crop of oats. The neighbor deliberately drives the cattle through it, ruining it.
And Roland orchestrates the counterattack, driving 25 cows into the neighbor's crop under the cover of darkness.
When you think about it, why didn't the neighbor retaliate again? Why did it end there?
Because frontier justice relies on mutual assured destruction. The neighbor knew he crossed a line, and Roland communicated without a single spoken word that he possessed the capability and the willingness to escalate.
So it established an unspoken treaty of respect.
Exactly.
It is an incredible evolution. We watch Roland go from a redheaded toddler playing make-believe with stones, getting stuck in high chairs, to a hardened young man enforcing treaties with herds of cattle in the wilderness.
But the memoir ends on a deeply surprising note.
It really does.
After conquering this environment, after surviving badger holes and runaway trains, Roland reflects on his life, walking behind the harrows, picking rocks out of the dirt. And his biggest lingering regret is that he quit school and never got a high school education.
I find that to be the most profound insight in the entire text. It perfectly captures a massive generational shift.
Yes. For Roland's father, the ultimate currency was raw muscle power, endurance, and land. Education was secondary to survival.
But Roland, reflecting back from 1985, realizes he lived through the pivot. He survived the era of the horse and the plow, but he foresaw that the rules of survival were changing.
He recognized that the future belonged to the educated.
It is a beautiful, bittersweet realization from a man who had already proven his intelligence out in the bush.
And it speaks directly to the resilience ingrained in your family line. To you, the listener tuning in, that stubborn ability to adapt, to endure physical hardship, to find humor in a nosebleed over split pea soup, or to engineer a dog sled out of strays.
That is your DNA. It is the literal foundation of why you are here today.
Which leaves us with a final vital thought. Think about the physical reality of the document we just discussed.
Yeah, this wildly entertaining, deeply moving history was not bound in a formal book. It was a loose piece of paper, a photocopy tucked away, entirely dependent on someone noticing it and deciding it mattered.
History is terrifyingly fragile. It is not just what happens, it's what we remember to write down.
So how many vivid, laugh-out-loud memories or quiet, lingering regrets are fading right now in your own mind? Or sitting untold in the memories of your relatives, just waiting for someone to ask the right questions?
Don't let your own history be a loose paper that gets lost to time.
Write your stories down today. Put them on the record.